WYBC New Haven.
I remember one time, I think I was in about 6th grade, maybe 5th grade, and I had this Sunday school teacher, and like we were learning about the story of when God asked Abraham to sacrifice his son, and like, you know, just like God was like testing Abraham's faith. And so the Sunday school teacher was like, so guys, how many of you have pets that you really love? So I was like, I have a guinea pig and I really love my guinea pig. And so the teacher was like, so if God, if you heard the voice of God telling you to kill your guinea pig by blowing it up in the microwave, could you do it?
That is correct.
And I was like, I was like, so I felt so trapped because I was like, I can't kill Cinnamon. I can't go to hell. Like, so then that was like one of the main turning points where I was like, that was really mean of God. I don't think that was right of him to ask Abraham to do that. And like, you know, like I think that was a very mean way to test somebody. And like, no, I wouldn't kill my guinea pig for you, God. I'm on the beat of the Dorani. I don't need your authority. Down with the moral majority. Cause I wanna be the minority. A pledge, allegiance to the underworld. One nation under dark, there of which I stand alone. A beast in the crowd, a song against the mold. Without a doubt, singled out the only way I do. Cause I wanna be the minority. I don't need your authority. Down with the moral majority.
Welcome to the Radley Porch. I'm Maddie Atkinson.
And I'm Rachel Haverford. As we grow up, we all have a moment when we realize the authority figures we thought were infallible are in fact mere mortals. This week's episode is about that realization. The people we look up to and respect can be wrong.
In the first segment, our friends talk about some of the ridiculous rules teachers imposed. Next, we talk about our run-ins with the law and legal authority. And finally, we face perhaps the most daunting authority of all, our parents. Like a ship runs from the earth, marching out of time. To my love now, the only way I know. One light, one mind, flashing in the dark, blinded by the silence of a thousand broken hearts. For crying out loud, she screamed unto me, afraid for all, f*** them all. You are your sight, cause I wanna be the minority. I don't need your authority. Down with the moral majority. Cause I wanna be the majority.
I think there's always a moment in your life, and I can't define when mine was, where you just realize that, like, these people, they might have power, but they're wrong. Like, whatever they're doing is wrong. Like, and I think I've always been this obedient kid, and I kind of listen to authority, and so maybe mine was a little later, but just the realization is like, why are we doing this? Like, what is the point?
I had a thing sort of like that with classes, like, I forget when it was, but like, you know, you used to go to class and you would be told things and they would be true and you would learn them, you know, and like, then you realize like, nobody actually, like, science, math, maybe less so, but like, for like, social sciences, like psychology, you know, government, whatever, like, people don't actually know anything about that. They just, like, have various theories, and, like, you want to say, like, okay, so why did, you know, so-and-so win an election, you know, and you have no idea. Nobody has any idea, and, you know, people will tell you.
Textbooks have the idea, and they're always right.
I mean, people...
Read it, it's true. Believe it.
Right. And it's, like, realizing that that line is false.
Well, I remember in 7th grade, we had these textbooks, that were written, I think, in, like, the 1970s or 80s, but it had this thing about that it said the Native Americans kept corn, and oftentimes the corn would ferment, and they would eat it anyway and get really drunk. And it was this thing of
trying to
promote discrimination.
And things, but wow.
Yeah, and it was I think it was a really old textbook because my school would buy, like, used textbooks. And so it was just a part that my teacher would be like, just ignore this. Everything else is right, but this, just ignore. And it was like, well, if this is wrong, then, like, what else is wrong? And like, this got published. Like, this had to go through a series of editors who said this was okay. So I think 7th grade was this big moment of me realizing, like, authority is not always right. I had... same teacher, 7th and 9th grade for English, and he's actually someone I really respect. Is one of the most amazing teachers because I had never thought, like, I could write, and, like, through his class, like, I got, kind of found my voice and what I liked to write, and then I was even good at writing, because I always thought of myself as, like, a math and science person, and, like, it was great. But I also, like, found him to be somewhat childish and rude, and I think, and because he would, like, he would cut off students when they were talking, especially if he just didn't think what they were saying was, like, bright enough to warrant class time, I guess. And to me, like, that was, like, unexcusable. Like, you should not do that to students. Like, especially if you're 12 years old. Like, it's hard. And then, so there's this girl who stuttered, right? And he was just brutal to her. And it's just, I couldn't understand this. And yeah, so I think that was a moment, and it was hard for me to understand, like, how do I respect this person at the same time as think he's, like, in some way this not awful person, but just has his flaws. I think that's something I have to, like, continually remind myself, that a person can still be, like, amazing in certain ways, but be flawed too.
In elementary school, I got in trouble for calling my teacher the wrong name.
Like, you forgot her name? This is
what you get in trouble for.
No, this is really an awful thing to get in trouble for. And, you know, have to precedent this with the fact that the teacher was an awful, mean teacher and did not like me. And she was always mean to me. Before she was even my teacher, I remember her being terribly mean to me. Anyway, when she was my teacher, there was this one time she was late to class or something. And so we were all kind of being obnoxious, and she steps in, and the whole class is being loud, and she said something about her name, like, oh, what's my, or she steps in, and people were like, oh, hello, Miss Leland, because that's what you're supposed to do, and she said something about her name, and I said, hello, Miss Bonnie Leland, and I remember I was, like, standing on this chair, I wasn't standing on the chair, I was kneeling on the chair, like, waving my ruler around as I, you know, proclaimed her name, and she stops cold, and she's, like, gives me this death stare, and she's like, excuse me, that is not my name. And I had no idea what was going on, because my mom's a school teacher, and I don't see, like, knowing my mom's an elementary school teacher, I didn't know what was wrong with that, and it wasn't like I sat there and said, hello, Bonnie. I still call her Mrs. Bonnie Leland. And so she proceeds to walk over, drag me out of the chair, grab me by the wrist, and drag me into the hallway.
Okay, so she's physically grabbed you?
Yes, and then has me look at the sign on her door that says her name, and she goes, what does that say? Of course, in the very mean, like, through her teeth, teacher way, she goes, what does that say? And I said, Mrs. Leland? She goes, yes. Do you see anything else in there? No. And then she goes, that's right. That's my name. There isn't any other part to it to you.
So this is just like a power trip.
I guess so. And then I was very upset because on the flip side, the intelligent part of my brain was like, but you have more than one part of your name. So I guess the other one, which is like the middle school version of the fifth grade story. I had a middle school teacher that couldn't stand me. But that was legitimate. She was my math teacher for 2 years. And the very first progress report, which was 3 weeks into the year, and algebra, whatever class it was, she had given me a C, and my lowest grade was a 95, and because she said at the start of the class, you know, kids, you have to keep a binder, and you have to organize it like this, and you have to put your tests here, and your quizzes there, and you have to keep track of everything, I had all of my stuff, and I was like, I would know if I was a C student, you know? So I get a C, and I was very upset, so I go up to her, and I take my binder, and I said, I'm sorry, I don't have a C, my lowest grade is a 95. And she declared, she looks in her grade book, she doesn't look at the paper, I don't think I brought my papers to her in the first place, I think I just walked up to her, and she declares to the whole class, no, Megan, you got the lowest grade on the last test, you got a 70, you have a 75. So I was, you know, now very embarrassed, very upset that she now has billed this to the whole class. And so I go back, and I look through my notes, and say, this isn't right. So the next day, I go up at the beginning of class again, and I said, I don't think you're right. Here's my test, and here are all my quizzes. And then, of course, now she's totally embarrassed. Turns out I actually got, like, a 98 on that test. My average in general was, like, a 97. And so she sits there and she then has to correct the whole class. Oh, see? Megan caught my mistake, kids. This is why you have to keep track of your papers, because teachers make mistakes, too. Which is still right. But from that point on, she hated me. Like, I embarrassed her terribly or something. She was awful to me.
One time, like, I was never afraid of... Well, I was always a little bit afraid of teachers, but, like... Then, like... Once, like, I didn't do my homework in this one class, and, like, the teacher was, like... The homework was to... I remember it was ancient history class. We were supposed to write up little index cards with, like, facts on them about... I think it was, like, some king of Assyria or something, and, like, I had forgotten to do it, or I had done it and left it at home. And so the teacher called on me, or, like, I didn't hand it in or something, and I was like, I'm sorry, Mr. Spence, I didn't do my homework, or I don't have it, something. And he... This was somehow, like, really a huge deal to him, and, like, after class, he, like, we had... I had left his classroom, and it was, like, a couple feet outside the door, and he was apparently standing outside in the hallway, you know, like, watching people go from class to class. This was in, like, seventh grade, I think. And he stops me, puts his hand around my neck, pushing me up against the wall.
Whoa.
Like,
he could have been fired.
He could have. Yeah. Like, I don't... And he was like, you're never gonna forget your homework again, are you? And I was like, no!
Oh, my God! Did you tell your parents?
Yeah, and then, like, my mom was all for, like, you know, like, she was gonna... tell the principal and, like, try and get the end. But I was, like, too scared of him, like, I was, like, too scared of him to, like, do anything about it. And, like, in retrospect, I definitely should have, like...
Yeah.
Because then I was kind of like, oh, you know, like, it's not that bad. It's really okay. Like, he's... But he was also creepy. Like, he would, like, walk around class and, like, rub people's shoulders or, like... It was a little, like, creepy.
One that definitely crosses the line, though.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
that was... a hand on your throat.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was...
I, like, couldn't breathe. I don't know why I was...
How
old?
Wow.
I was... like 12, I think. And like, this is the thing, like, it happened in front of like everybody in the hallway, and everyone was like,
yeah.
When then he walked, like, he went back into his classroom, everyone was like, oh my god, like, are you okay, like, what just happened?
Oh gosh.
And the thing that made me really mad in fifth grade, the teacher, she was not very smart. Like, I had to, like, she didn't like me because I had to correct her all the time, and that was another thing. Like, I always felt really awkward correcting her, but I also felt, like, guilty if I knew that the rest of the class was learning something wrong. So, like, I had to, like, correct the teacher. And so, like, she got really, like, she hated me by the end of the year. And, like, there was this homework assignment where the homework assignment was, we were learning about, you know, like, ethnic ancestry or something. And she was like, okay, guys, your homework for today is to find a recipe that your family cooks on special occasions that reflects your ethnic heritage, because it's a recipe from the country your family came from. And I was like, I got home and I was like, we don't have any, like, I can't do this assignment. Like, we don't ever cook any, like, Irish or Italian delicacies, you know? Like, we're not gonna make, like, German strudel. Or, like, I just, like, don't do it.
Yeah.
And, so we came, so, like, and but I was so upset, like, I was crying because I was like, oh no, I can't do my homework, I got such a goody two-shoes, you know?
It's such a sense of guilt.
So, and so my mom wrote me this note saying, like, dear Mrs. Rand, I'm sorry that, like, so, like, Samantha really tried this assignment, but, like, our family, like, doesn't do this, like, you know, whatever. So, like, I brought this note into the class, and the teacher got really mad because, like, half the class didn't do it because, it, like, such a specific
right.
assignment, we couldn't do it. And she got, like, and then she got really mad, I think, because, like, she realized that it was a stupid assignment, but, like, so she was mad at herself, but she spent, like, 10 minutes straight yelling at all of us. And then, like, she saw, like, I had a note from my mother, and, like, she got so mad at me for, like, I don't know, she's like, I don't want a note for your mother, this won't make it better, like, how dare you not do this homework assignment? I'm so sorry. Oh, God, that's terrible.
Oh, that is awful.
Or, like, oh, in middle school, for recess, like, so for, we had lunch period, and then we had recess, but it was forced, like, you have to go outside, and, like, even if you weren't done with your lunch, they would, like, throw you outside, and, like, but we didn't, like, our recess took place in the parking lot, because, like, we didn't have any, like, field
that's
or any,
terrible.
Like, so it was just in the parking lot, and, like, we,
were there cars in the parking lot?
Yeah. No,
oh God, I've heard on a regular playground every day.
Yeah.
Soft ground.
No, but I mean, like, but that's the thing. So we weren't allowed to do anything
yeah.
because it was a, like my friend and I once got in trouble for playing a game wherein we kicked a can on the ground. Like, we got in trouble for playing kick the can because he was like, that might hurt somebody. in the head.
You're just supposed to stand in the
sun supposed to
and,
stand
like,
there. And then, like, and then, okay.
Wait, could you run?
We weren't allowed to play tag. We started playing, like, have you ever played the Wonder Ball? Where, like, you sit in a circle and, like, whoever
right.
ends up, like, when the song ends, you're out. We got in trouble for doing that for some reason. Like, so finally.
They wanted you to be bored.
The only game yeah. that my friend and I could think of to play that we would not get in trouble for was, you know, like, all the cracks in the asphalt because of the sun uh-huh. or whatever. We would try and, like, we would start at different ends and try and walk along the cracks only and meet up in the center.
Mm-hmm.
And we got in trouble for that for some reason. yeah. Because, like, it took us too close to, like, you know, the boundary of the... It was like,
oh, my God. I stuttered when I was little. Every now and then I do, but mm-hmm. very, very, very rarely. And it was bad in that I would stutter and I would say things wrong, almost like a drunk person, you know? I'm not mm-hmm. as drunk as I think I am. I would mix things up. Really badly. And so I was at the peak of my stuttering problems, and the teacher, who had actually been the one that referred me to the speech therapist to get it fixed, she sits there one day, and this kid, one of my friends had come up, and he wrinkled my paper. He came up, and he crinkled it all up. Now, I went to, so of course, because he messed up my paper, I went up to the teacher, and I said, Miss, he tinkled my paper. Because, you know, the combination of crinkled and wrinkled or whatever else I could have said about what mm-hmm. he did and the fact that I was stuttering. So I don't think I wound up and said, oh, he tinkled my paper. I said, he did the, and I, mm-hmm. and then I said, like, inkled my paper. So it came out as tinkle. And so she pulls me out into the hallway and she yells at me and she gives me whatever form of punishment they gave me then, which I guess wasn't that bad because I can't remember it. And gave me something for some sort of vulgar language and goes and tells my parents. And then my mom got very upset because she was like, she stutters. You're the one that referred her for speech therapy and you're getting her and yelling at her for that.
I got in trouble once for, like, some kid, like, punched me. Mm-hmm. And I got in trouble for telling the teacher because yeah. she was like, we don't like tattletales in this class. And it was like, okay, fine, like, don't tattle. And you're like, she touched me.
You.
But, like, if it's, it was, she was basically saying, like, I don't care. Like, I don't want to hear about, like, any of your problems. Like,
mm-hmm.
don't tell me. And, like, I just lost so much, like, I just lost faith in that teacher forever after mm-hmm. that because it was, like...
I broke my collarbone several times
huh.
when I was little. And one of the times, so we had this big, silly rule where for the last 5 minutes or so in the cafeteria, they would, to get us to calm down before we left, they would turn the lights off, or, you know, half the lights on, and we all had to put our heads on the table.
Mm-hmm.
And that act of putting my neck down so far and turning my head to put it on the table hurt my arm because it was broken. You know, like that part of my arm was broken. And so I wouldn't do it. And this teacher, this was third grade, she comes up and she gets in my face and she's like, no, you have to put your head down. And so I put my head down and I'm like crying. Because
did she know that your collarbone
was
broken?
Yes, I have my arm in a sling. And I explained to her, I can't, it hurts, and she goes, no, you have to put your head down, and I remember I put my head down, and I was crying, and I went home, and I told my mom, and that was the other time. My mom will tell people this till they, oh, she was so mad about that.
Been listening to The Radley Porch on Yale Radio 1340.
Out of state or something on this payphone, and so I
really little and it's been like 4 and I dialed 0 and it took me like a little while to like dial the rest of the numbers, mm-hmm. and so I just called the operator. And this woman on the other end of the phone said, "Hello." And I was like, "What?" I got like really startled, and then I hung up the phone and I picked it up again, dialed 0 again, and it went back to the operator. And like, for some reason, the woman on the other end of the phone just like flipped out and said, she's like, I know, you teenagers or whatever, I know where you are and I'm gonna come find you, and I, you know, and just like went on. And I was like 4 and I was like really afraid, and I also had this feeling that I'd done something terribly wrong, and I like wouldn't tell my parents. But I would never want to, like, I refused to go back to Wendy's. And I really confused. Like, I just like wonder, like, what kind of person is so like is so tightly wound.
I remember I had another really guilty story like that. I was at an airport once, and they had those payphones where you put in a quarters or whatever, and then you can dial numbers. I'd always really wanted to dial 911, and I figured, you know, I knew that these phones would not work until you put in money. Apparently, as I was able to discover, for any number but 911.
Right.
So I pick up the phone, I dial 911, and somebody picks up, and I just wig out and like get my pills. I'm just like, figuring out, like, I'm sorry, but no. It was so dramatic.
Senior skip day. Did you guys have that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, except I had a play that day, so, and if you didn't go to school, you couldn't be in the play.
Well, we were in the habit, second semester, senior year, we had nothing left to do. We'd go out and play basketball after school. It was a really fun thing, a whole group of us would do. And so for senior skip day, we organized a giant group basketball game. It was about 30 of us. Went out, because for senior skip day, we had to go to class for the first two class periods, and then we all caravanned over to this one.
So it was like a school-sanctioned senior skip day?
We were actually allowed to be in school that day.
Oh, we just had like a actually skip school senior skip day.
No, we had to go through second period. And if we were there for both of those, it wasn't counted as an absence. Mm. It was some weird thing, school sanctioned senior skip day. And so we all went caravaned over to this one neighborhood with this nice couple basketball courts, because there were so many of us. And so we're there playing basketball. Okay? We're playing basketball. Middle of the day, in a neighborhood basketball court, minding our own business, when a cop walks up. And this just makes me angry. I hate this story. This cop walks up to us and says, "Hey, what do you think you're doing?" And we're like, "We're playing basketball." And then he says, "You're all parked the wrong way on the street." And this is where I learned if you have to be parked the direction of traffic, even mm-hmm. if it's a two-way street.
Mm-hmm.
So somehow we had all parked the wrong way, because we were parked on the side by the basketball court, which meant we pulled mm-hmm. over. So he told us we all had to go turn our cars around. And we're like, "Oh my gosh, okay." And then he goes, for the sake of being, like, a jerk cop, because some of them exist, he says, "Do any of you live in this neighborhood anyway?" And of the 30 of us, I'll be darned, not a single one of us actually live in that neighborhood. Of course, we were all familiar with it, mm-hmm. because we all grew up in this town, and we knew this neighborhood, and we all had best friends that lived there. They just weren't mm-hmm. there. And this one kid goes, "I used to live here, but I moved out a couple months ago. And then I moved to another new neighborhood." He's like, that should count. And the cop goes, "You all have to leave." So this was like the nicest, best, free. I mean, you can't go play mm-hmm. basketball anywhere that besides a gym somewhere. That was outdoors. That was nice. That actually had, you know, baskets and rims and nets. And so we were like, okay. And so he banished us and sat there and waited and watched us all leave. All like 30 of us. And then we had to go find some other really crappy basketball court. But I left, I was so angry, because I'm like, it is senior skip day. We're a group of kids from the top of our class, playing basketball. We could be off doing who knows what. We're being productive, we're being good, happy kids, playing sports, being active, not disturbing anybody. It's not like anyone else was trying to use the courts. It's the middle of the day. Any other kid on the, you know, around should be in school.
Mm-hmm.
And we're like, you know, half of our class was off smoking pot somewhere in an alley 3 streets down. And it's like, why don't you go spend your time better yelling at those kids than yelling at a bunch of good kids playing basketball?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and I couldn't imagine that.
Yeah, it's like a mix of power trip and also that he could catch you, right? Like, he can't catch the kids in the alley smoking pot.
He could if he wasn't looking at us.
Yeah.
He drove down the street and found them.
You know?
and he was threatening, too. He was like, if you don't leave, I'm going to write you all tickets.
My friend Tyson and I, back in high school, thought we were very clever pranksters and thought we would pull a big senior prank on our high school. And to do so, we were going to go on campus at night, and I think our plan was to throw tires over the flagpole. It wasn't a very good plan. It wasn't very firmly filled out, but, you know, we sort of wanted to just get out there and have fun, and so we thought we would go and scout the campus at night and see if this was going to be feasible, because we knew that there were some cameras and a security guard, and so we wanted to make sure we could get around all that. And so one evening, we told both our parents we were going for a run, and left my car in a parking lot, and rode together in his car near the school, and parked it on the side of the road, and we changed into full-length black, black long-sleeve t-shirts, black gloves, black running tights, I believe.
masks?
Yes, ski masks, black hats. We were all over black. And we had a bag full of, I don't know, like a whistle and some tools in case we wanted to use tools. I really don't remember why we did all, you know, a lot of this sort of seemed sort of cool and rebellious at the time, I'm sure. And so we ran around onto the campus, and we parked our car sort of, I guess you'd say, near the west side of campus, and we sort of looped around and, you know, thought we were not, it was safely tucked away, and we ran around and came on from the north side of campus. We ran on, and we saw a car in one of the parking lots, in, like, the upper parking lot, which was near where we'd come in, and thought, okay, there's the security guard. So he's now, you know, going to be circling around some other way. We'll kind of loop around behind the school and just start checking things out. So we ran up behind the gym, and we checked to see if the doors were unlocked. They were locked, of course. And we were walking away from there. I forget exactly where we wanted to go. We wanted to, you know, sort of poke around the edges before we went into the main area where the flagpole was, where we actually wanted to do our mischief when the time came. And we were walking away from these doors of the gym when down this path, there was sort of an elevated path that ran over a hill and sort of dead-ended into the wall of the gym. So we were walking away from the doors, and down this path comes the security guard shining a flashlight. And it was sort of bobbing along as he walked, and so it flashed across us, but it wasn't clear whether he had looked up and seen us, and then it, you know, swung down again. So we froze for a moment, and then sprinted and ran down to the baseball field and hid in the baseball dugout. Oh, you think he saw us? I don't know. Did he see us? Maybe he saw us. He went back to his car, apparently, drove away past us, and we thought, you know, my goodness, we got away, you know, aren't we lucky? So we started, you know, now a little bit more on edge and more carefully, running away across the baseball field, sort of running to the back of the field, when the car pulls back up. I thought, oh, okay, I guess he did see us. And he pulls out his flashlight and sort of waves it over the field, but we were pretty confident he couldn't see us, because it wasn't a very bright flashlight. We were, of course, creatures of blackness, well designed to escape his notice. But, you know, this was clearly trouble, so we ran all the way to the back of the field, which is at the, you know, so we're now on the very west edge of campus. Then another car pulls in. I think, uh-oh. He called in, you know, some more security company flunkies. And this car pulls out not a flashlight, but a spotlight. And sweeps the entire field, and you know, we're thinking, can they see us? Can they see us? Of course they could see us. You know, this thing was brighter than day, and here we were, you know, two guys in black on the green grass in front of a yellow bench in a gray fence. Like, you know, there was no question of our black suits protecting us from vision in this case. We'd clearly been spotted, but we weren't that smart just yet. Then another car pulls in and sweeps the field, and another car pulls in and sweeps the field. So all in all, eventually, there was the security guard and four of these security flunkies, as I was still thinking of them, although Tyson, being a little quicker than me, had figured out that these were the police. So we're thinking, you know, do they know we're here? Because we aren't very bright. But it became clear that they did when one of the guys got out of his car with his spotlight, pointed at us, and started walking towards us. I think they see us. So we got up and started sprinting along the fence, and we came to this gate. Gate, get here! Pulled open the gate, ran out. There was this, you know, tree or hill full of brushes and brambles and whatnot that you sort of ran down. Then it was just behind the fields, I guess, and there was a little creek down to the bottom, and you could run up a hill out onto the road that we'd parked on. So we went sprinting through this, slapping away branches that were, you know, slicing our faces and slashing us all over. Behind us, we heard somebody yell, "Stop! We won't shoot!" But oh no, we were gone. We were running. We were out of there.
Stop.
Yes, yes, in retrospect, this would have been the point where I would have stopped. You know, we ran through there, we splashed our way into the stream, ran along that a little bit, popped that onto the road. There's our car. We just got to cross the road, get to the car, get out of there, and there comes another squad car cruising down the road and parks right behind our car, which, it should be noted, is an illegally parked Ford Taurus in one of the wealthier neighborhoods of St. Louis. There was no question this car belonged here. And so, we sneaked across the road and through these people's backyards and sort of sneaked around behind our car to see if by any chance we could get to it without this guy noticing. But not a chance. He was parked immediately behind the thing. There was no way you could get to it without bothering him. Okay. This would be another point where, sensibly, we would have turned ourselves in. But sensible was not one of our strong suits at this point. So, we think, alright, how are we going to handle this? Well, maybe if we just evade their grasp long enough, some solution will present itself. So we decide that the best thing for us to do is to run all the way to our friend Jack's house, who lives several miles away, and find some excuse for spending the night there, and try to retrieve Tyson's car in the morning. Okay. So we set out, you know, sneaking through people's backyards, through St. Louis Country Club, which is the area that we'd parked in and that we were now trying to make our way through. On our way, we, like, accidentally run onto somebody's swimming pool cover and find ourselves, you know, standing on this thing as the water pours in around our feet. It's November, I should note. So we got our feet all soaked, staggered out of that. Finally, we make our way out onto the golf course, and we're actually now pretty near where we ran originally around from our car to the school, and we see the police out searching the golf course about 100 yards away from us. They've got their flashlights out, and they're, like, looking at this green, and we'd actually stopped there earlier to take a bathroom break on the way into the on the way into the school. So now we're really freaked out. You know, we duck across, we manage to make our way out of there, we, like, halt at the edge of the... We have to cross one more main road. So we sort of halt there and keep peering out of the brushes and finally scurry across the road and then, you know, seek safety on the other side. From that point, we decided that we didn't... You know, we needed to stop looking like criminals.
Yeah, you'd be a little sketchy.
So I take off all my shirts. I am now wearing full-length black running tights and nothing on my top.
Is this less sketchy?
I thought so. It's November. I forget what Tyson... I think Tyson may have managed a more reasonable conversion into a non-criminal-looking individual. And then we run. We cross the municipal line and feel that, you know, we've in some way made ourselves safe by doing so. We run all the way to our friend's house. It's 11 or so when we knock on his door. Jack, you've got to help us. He's thinking, you know, what on earth is going on here? Here's Rad, here's Tyson, you know, in ski masks. You know, we were not wearing them at the time, although he sometimes tells the story that we were. So we come up with the following plan. We're going to spend the night at our friend Anton's house, because we think his parents will let us get away with this sort of nonsense. The story will be that Tyson had too many burgers for dinner and is sick and can't drive back to his home in the distant suburbs. I forget what my story was going to be. We're going to go to Anton's house, and then in the morning, we think that the cops will have a shift change, which will necessitate leaving the car unguarded. And during this opportunity, we will retrieve the car. And, you know, once the car's back in our hands, everything's okay. Surely. So Anton actually gets in his car.
Write down the license plate number.
Gets in his car and comes over and I think brings us some clothes to change into so that you know, we won't shock his parents who are having a dinner party by walking in our criminal attire. What we have to do then to set this up is notify our parents. So Tyson calls his dad and says, "Dad, you know, it's me. I had a few too many deer burgers for dinner. I'm really not feeling good after the run, and I think I'm going to spend the night here in St. Louis at Anton's house." And his dad says, "Tyson, where is your car?" Which I can hear over his cell phone, and my stomach just goes, you know, sinks. And Tyson says, "Oh, it's here with me at Anton's house." And his dad says, "Tyson, where is your car?" So it comes out that what had happened was that the police had seen the little John Burroughs School parking sticker in Tyson's car, had, you know, drawn conclusions from this and called the principal saying, you know, is there an individual of this name attending your school? You know, we can see his record, but we can't actually find his phone number because he's from a different suburb in our records. The principal responds, "Well, yes, there is. Here is his parents' phone number." They get a call. They pass the information along to my folks since they know that Tyson and I were out running together. And so we both have rather interesting conversations with our fathers, and then I believe they come pick us up at Jack's house, and we're taken back to school where we meet the security guard who says, "Why on earth did you boys run away?" And we say, "Well, because we thought we could get away." We retrieve.
It does seem like they put a lot of effort into chasing you for trespassing.
Well, that was the thing, is that it later turned out that the security guard hadn't really just thought it was trespassing. He would have if, you know, we'd just been wearing ordinary school kid clothes, but the fact that we were dressed as, you know, terrorists caused him to conclude that something far more dubious was afoot. And apparently scared the living crap out of him at the same time. You know, he was actually having about as bad a day as we were when he first saw us. Since, you know, the last thing your 65-year-old retired cop really wants to do is handle high crimes taking place on his pretty easy evening beat. So we retrieved my bag of stuff. Then we headed off to the police department. We get there, and the first thing that the officer says to us was, "So how was it having a dog on your tail?" To which we respond, "What?" Turns out that after they'd called out literally half the squad cars from this municipality's police department, they then called county and got a dog, because, you know, who knows what kind of trouble this is. You want to make sure you track down the terrorists. And apparently the dog's handler was bragging about how, you know, once the dog catches up, it is trained to hold on and let go, or not let go until it's been specifically ordered to. Luckily for us, we'd, you know, either by splashing through the stream or by walking on somebody's pool cover, we'd lost our scent, and the dog did not find us. But it did. The reason they were searching the golf course where we'd been was that we had, attracted the dog's attention to that spot. But it had followed us all the way around through campus, right up until we lost it in the woods at the very end. So they take us into the interrogation room, sit us down, get our information, social security numbers, full story of what we've been doing. Then they list off all the crimes they could charge us with. You know, because we tried to open the doors, you know, attempted breaking and entering or something. There's a long list. We can meanwhile hear our parents talking with more cops, or both of our fathers, you know, this being sort of a fatherly responsibility, apparently, are the two who are there. We can hear our parents talking with the cops out in the outside room. At one point, somebody asks them, "So why are they both wearing tights?" My dad responds, "They're runners." At another point, we hear my dad, and this was possibly the most comforting part of the whole evening, we hear my dad saying to one of the cops, "Well, of course, I did much worse things than this when I was the boy's age, but we won't be telling them that." So I think, okay, it is possible to go on in life after a night like this.
That's not going to kill me.
So, you know, they threaten us pretty good, but then they say, you know, the school is nice, they're probably not going to press charges. We get taken home. My parents tell me how I've destroyed all faith they ever had in me.
Wait, did they arrest you for anything, or...?
I don't know exactly the meaning of the term arrest. You know, we were taken into the station, we didn't have to go to jail. No charges were filed, they filled out a police report and could have pressed charges had the school wished to, but they let it go. I'm grounded for a month. We have to write letters of apology to all concerned. Then we have our hearing with the principal the next day of school. This happened, I think, on a Saturday or a Friday night, I forget which. And then Monday we were going to go in and talk to him. So we had to show up early for school and sit outside his office until he was ready to see us. Go on in. Well, you know, we're in deep doo-doo, is the basic message. But as it goes on, he sort of softens up, and he's apparently playing the good cop. We later find out that the 11th and 12th grade principal, our specific boss, would be playing the bad cop. So, you know, he finally just, you know, what it boils down to is he says, "Boys, just promise me you'll never wear ski masks again." Okay, we will promise you that. Then we have our meeting promise with the actual, you know, the guy who's, yes, and I have broken that promise. we have our meeting with the guy who's actually responsible for disciplining us, the 11th and 12th grade principal. And what comes out in this meeting is that, you know, although they won't say it for this reason, the fact that we are the good boys, the smart boys, is going to pay off for us. They can't actually suspend us because that would go on our records and screw up their chances of bragging about what schools we go to later on in life. So we're safe on that regard. We will, however, be on disciplinary probation for the rest of our academic career. I should specify that this is halfway through senior year of high school. Okay. We have another meeting with the head principal after that, but, you know, we've got our punishment. We have, I think, you know, a number of hours of detention each to serve off, which is the first time either of us has received detention. Tyson had been on the student court and was forced to give up his seat on that. And that's that.
So how did it feel to get in all this trouble with your parents, with the police, with the school?
Like, for about 2 to 3 days, we were deeply, deeply contrite. Shortly after that, the fact that this had vastly increased our social standing, and that we'd gotten pretty good at telling the story, and that certain of our teachers were hinting that they thought this was incredibly cool... Our contrition didn't last that long. You know, I think at some point when I was serving one of my detentions, the principal who, you know, handed down our sentence was the guy supervising it. He left the room and everybody said, you know, "Ryle, tell the story, tell the story." And he came back in when I was in the middle of cracking everyone up with a rendition of this story and sort of shook his head in disappointment. you know, it was clear that the punishment had not had its intended effect. One of the detentions actually was on a day when it was a Saturday session for a program I did some work with where, you know, inner city kids would come out here and do like a summer school, or during the year they'd do like a Saturday session school. And they saw me and they're like, "Oh, Rob, you're coming here to work with us." I was like, "No, guys, I have detention." And they're like, "Oh, Rob got detention? What did you get detention for, Rob?" It's like, well, yeah, it's kind of untraditional, actually. but... all in all, I mean, I think that both of us found the experience of having been thrown on disciplinary probation to actually be a positive one for us. so really not an effective means of discipline. We didn't quite buy into the belief that just being in trouble was bad enough for that to be really effective, and nothing they'd actually done to us as punishment was so severe as to really chasten us that badly. I think on the whole, we qualified the thing as a mistake at first, but we've both come to appreciate telling the story enough, including the parts of the story about how, you know, blatantly stupid we were, like running straight back towards our own car when the heat was really on.
Running when his head stopped, we won't shoot.
Yes, yeah, that was the other one.
The only time I ever kind of got in trouble with the police, I was home from college on spring break, and me and a couple of friends... it was the middle of the night, and we had gone, and we were exploring / trespassing at this abandoned mental asylum or TB sanitarium, and we got back to where our car was parked, and there was this police officer waiting for us. He was actually from the Department of Natural Resource Police, and I guess there was nothing better to do in that county that night than to wait for us, because actually his partner had gone off shift, and he had staked us out, and so he takes our IDs, and he's going to run them through the system. So we're standing out, it's kind of cold, and he's in there for like half an hour running our IDs through the system, and we're kind of waiting. So it was a little bit of a power trip, but on the other hand, you know, we were legitimately trespassing. And he does the same thing as your police officer, Megan, where he kind of threatens, you know, I could get you for walking on the train tracks, and then you'd have to come into the station and, you know, be arrested. And so it's kind of that same little, like, what am I doing? I'm a bored police officer. Let me mess with these kids a little bit.
Have you noticed it affecting how you approach the police sense? I mean, I guess you didn't have a very negative experience with them, so perhaps not. But I think that was, in my case, the first time I'd ever really seen the police as adversaries instead of as allies. And I've definitely had whenever a police spotlight flashes over me since that time, it freaks me out.
Not too much, because, I mean, this guy was a little bit on a power trip, like, taking our IDs and sitting, you know, we were out in the cold, and he's sitting there for, like, half an hour looking at them. I don't know what he's doing in the car. So he was, but that was more in like a like funny, spoofy movie kind of silly way. There was no like being chased by six squad cars.
You're listening to the Radley Push on WYBC 1340 AM.
I think there's also a moment where you realize that your parents could be wrong.
I feel like maybe it has something to do with
and I think it's really an odd moment. Because I know, I think for me, it's this really weird thing where I used to, I talk to my grandmother every week, and she lives in China. And so, there's a time change, right? And so I always had to figure out in my head, like, what time it was there, and so what time it would be appropriate to call her. And, I had realized that it was it was 13-hour difference, but my mom had thought it was a 14-hour difference, and I was like, I went through this entire proof and was like, Mom, I think you're wrong, and like to the end, she wouldn't say she's wrong, but like it was that just the idea that I had this proof and I had figured it out, and like I knew she was wrong, and I was.
I wonder if it would have been different if she had admitted she was wrong. Like, if it would have been less of a blow if she'd been like, oh, yeah. Or would it have been more of a blow if she had, like, realized admitted her own fallibility?
Yeah.
I don't know.
But I think the fact that I had figured it out, there was something for me that was, like, A, my detective work that kind of built this up, but also B, that, like, I had never thought of her as being able to be wrong.
Because they had two sons, and then they adopted a daughter, and they... from Russia, and they all went to Russia and came back. This girl Sasha, who's 8-year-old, and she's probably like 6 years younger than her next oldest brother. And I guess her parents took kind of like they just like wanted their, you know, they like just kept telling their sons like this is your sister, and like, you know, this is your younger sister, and like you have to love her, and she's your sister, and they like really wanted their kids to like understand that she was their sister, like no matter that she was 8-year-old and like brought her home. And like the and it was like it's like a really I mean, it's like a really good thought and like a really important thing to like teach your kids. But like the end result of that was that the oldest son would like take it literally, and he would like get on his tricycle and like ride around the neighborhood and like tell everyone he ran into that like if you like that's my little sister, and like if anyone ever speaks to her, like that's my little sister, and you better watch out. And it's like so funny the way that like the people don't realize like how much they like
listen.
Yeah, like how much power they have, or like how like kind of influential these things are.
I think for me, like I went through like. Like, first, I think I realized that, I first realized my mother was fallible, and there was, like, she hates math and is, like, really bad at it, and it got to, like, and again, it was, like, in the fourth grade where, like, I first brought her home something, and she was, like, let's not discuss this. And then I think my dad is next, and then I think the last person that I believed was infallible for the longest time was my older sister.
When was the last moment?
I think they must have
Like, what was that realization with her?
Because we used it.
I still believe that she has like really, really good judgment, and I think to the point where in high school I would like write papers, and if she disagreed with what like one teacher had to say, like I like always be like,
"Said a period."
Yeah, I'd be like, "Well, my sister says," and I think so. I mean, I think it lasted for like you usually like when you're a kid, you're especially after that. As you become a teenager, you kind of grad at it. But I think it lasted for me, like, through being a teenager. I think, like, maybe... And it's still to some extent true because I trust her judgment so much. I think it's, like, maybe the first time that she ever called me with a problem. And I just, like, had this, like... I mean, like, not necessarily, like, a sense of power, but just, like, this feeling that, like... That, like, it cuts both ways. And,
yeah.
And I think that was maybe when she left for college and was, like, lonelier, you know, something like that. And then I think that maybe I realized that, like, also part of it is that I think we have very similar, like, moral compasses like, and, like, very similar judgment. I think, like, part of the reason that I trust her is because I think that she does what I think that I should be doing in a situation. And like, I think that that's, like, and I think that's really, that's something that's, like, valuable to me.
Yeah.
It's just guidance.
But I think it's a point where you think of yourself as equal. For you, I guess, with your sister as well as your parents, but for me, it's definitely like with my parents. When I think, like, my judgment is like worthy to counterbalance theirs.
So this house across the street from me, or across the street in one down, had this really bad habit of parking their Lexus in their lawn, and they did it so much that they tore the living daylights out of the grass, and so it was just mud and slush and stuff, and they had no grass anymore. So they finally got new grass, and they laid out the new grass, and they put a sign up for themselves that said, "Do not park on grass." And they also bought about 6 giant orange street cones and lined them up across the edge of the grass so that they literally couldn't park there without running over the cones. And so, of course, my family and I thought this was about the stupidest thing ever. And we were in the habit, this was junior, senior year of high school. We went to the beach a lot on the weekends and on breaks. And so my friends would come over, or they'd come over to do anything. And the first time they saw those cones, they were like, "This is the stupidest thing ever." And so a couple days ago, since the first time they saw that, my friends all came over to go to the beach. And we used to go to the beach at like 4 o'clock in the morning, just for the sake of getting there when the sun came up. And because it was 4, and no one would notice, we thought, you know, this is so stupid. We have to do something. Like, they're asking for it. So between the however many cars we had, we stole their cones, put them in our truck, and drove away. Now, of course, we're not terrible people. We weren't going to, like, steal their cones and not do anything with it. So we waited a couple days, and then in the middle of the night, a couple days later, I was a peewee soccer coach, so I had these little miniature cones. And so we took the little miniature cones, and we put them there in place of their tall cones. And we put a sign on it that said, "We're sorry, we just wanted to wash them, but they shrunk in the dryer." And then the most amusing thing, as you know, this is going on, is we would drive by. I remember, like, every time I drive by with my mother, like, she goes, "Hey, their cones are gone. I wonder why that is." And then a couple days we go by and she goes, "Oh, they have little ones now. Isn't that cute?" And I'm just like thinking, I'm glad you don't recognize those cones, Mom. And so the next time we went to do something, it was another trip to the beach, like a week later, 4 o'clock in the morning, 5 o'clock in the morning. We decided it was time to start giving them their cones back. So we took one car load and we flipped them every other cone. It was a tall one, a little one, a tall one, a little one. And we go to the beach. We come back. My parents greet me at the door. And they said, "Megan, we got a call about 5 o'clock this morning. Something about vandalism with some cones. Yeah, the cops visited us." And my friends and I were like, "Oh my God." And my parents let us sit there in a pure state of panic for about 30 seconds. And then they started busting up laughing. Apparently, no. Of course, no cops had called or noticed. No one even knew. The people across the street never even knew we did this. My parents caught us because my mom, who can't sleep through anything, the way we were parked and the way that house was positioned, the lights from our headlights while we were doing this woke up my mom. Wow. And she looked out the window and saw us doing it. And they thought it was amusing. And so then my parents were like, oh, you know what we should do next? they wanted us to go out and put the cones around their car so that it was stopped. Like it was blocked in. But, so that was mostly the threat of cops from my parents. In retrospect, I don't think my parents would have talked to me like that if the cops had called and
A famous example of questioning authority comes from John Updike's famous short story, A&P, narrated by the grocery clerk, Sammy. Three girls in bathing suits have come into the store, and as they go to check out, the manager begins to yell at them.
Girls, I don't want to argue with you. After this, come in here with your shoulders covered. It's our policy. He turns his back. That's policy for you. Policy is what the kingpins want. What the others want is juvenile delinquency.
In a famous act of defiance against the girls' treatment, Sammy decides to quit his job.
The girls, and who'd blame them, are in a hurry to get out, so I say, I quit to Langle, quick enough for them to hear, hoping they'll stop and watch me, their unsuspected hero. They keep right on going, into the electric eye. The door flies open, and they flicker across the lot to their car, Queenie in plaid and big, tall Goonie, not that is raw material, she was so bad, leaving me with Langle and a kink in his eyebrow. Did you say something, Sammy? I said I quit. I thought you did. You didn't have to embarrass them. It was they who were embarrassing us. I started to say something that came out fiddle-dee-doo. It's a saying of my grandmother's, and I know she would have been pleased. I don't think you know what you're saying, Langle said. I know you don't, I said, but I do. I pulled the bow at the back of my apron and start shrugging it off my shoulders. A couple of customers that had been heading for my slot begin to knock against each other like scared pigs in a chute. Langle sighs and begins to look very patient and old and gray. He's been a friend of my parents for years. Sammy, you don't want to do this to your mom and dad, he tells me. It's true, I don't, but it seems to me that once you begin a gesture, it's fatal not to go through with it. I fold the apron, Sammy stitched in red on the pocket, and put it on the counter, and drop the bow tie on top of it. The bow tie's theirs, if you've ever wondered. You'll feel this for the rest of your life, Langle says. And I know that's true, too, but remembering how he made that pretty girl blush makes me so scrunchy inside, I punch the no-sale tab, and the machine whirs people, and the door splats out.
In olden days, a glimpse of stocking was looked on as something shocking. Now heaven knows anything goes. Good authors too, who once knew better words, now only use four letter words, writing prose. Anything goes. The world has gone mad today, and good's bad today, and black's white today, and day's night today, when most guys today that woman prize today are just silly gigolos. So though I'm not a great romancer, I know that you're bound to answer when I propose that anything goes.
Thanks for joining us for this week's episode of The Radley Porch on WYBC New Haven. Listen to us next week at the same time in the same place.
You can also catch our free podcast on iTunes by searching the iTunes store for The Radley Porch. Again, that's for free.
See you next week.
Anything goes. The world has gone mad today, and good's bad today, and black's white today, and day's night today, when most guys today that woman prize today are just silly gigolos. So though I'm not a great romancer, I know that you're bound to answer when I propose. Anything goes.